You may recall that some 8 months ago, I spoke to you on this same theme. Will there be war in the Middle East? In January of 1964, 13 Arab chiefs of state had come to Cairo for a pan-Arab summit conference. The result of that conference had been an announcement, a threat, that if Israel, in fact, turned on the tap of its Jordan Valley water diversion project, the Arab states would launch an all-out attack against Israel. The tap had been turned on, and there had been no war. And many were saying that the Middle East was simmering off and cooling down. And now was the time again to begin to do business, to sell arms, to give aid to all of the nations in this part of the world. I was concerned in October of last year with a prevailing feeling that President Nasser and dictator Hafiz of Syria, and King Hussein of Jordan, seemed to have grown up. They had presumably renounced war as their ultimate solution to what they delight to call the Israel problem. It was being bruited about the halls of our State Department and published in learned journals that, in fact, the summit conference had been largely for internal, domestic, political consumption. The Arabs had not meant at all what they said. Here was the proof. There had not been an attack. And this argument was being raised wherever men wished to explain our policy of sending military equipment to Jordan and to the Lebanon, two of the signatories to the summit conference agreements. Wherever people wanted to explain and exculpate our continuing aid to General Nasser in the form of food and wheat, wherever men wanted to excuse and to explain our unwillingness to sell arms to Israel, or to enter into any strong, definite treaty with that democracy in that part of the world. In late summer of 1964, a second summit conference was held with these same principles in Cairo. And again there was no war. And again voices were heard in the land saying, the Near East was moving as the world itself was moving towards a détente. And the Arabs had rejected war as an instrument of policy. That, as a matter of fact, so it was argued, this summit conference had not been called for its announced purpose to organize and plan the final battle of extermination, the battle that is designed to erase Israel from the face of the globe. Rather, this had been the cover behind which the various Arab chiefs of state were eager to organize and to arrange their own internecine squabbles. And indeed, the fabric of the Arab world was badly frayed. Saudi Arabia and Egypt were in a bitter and brutal and bloody war in the Yemen. King Hussein had just foiled a Nasserite plot on his own life. Algeria and Tunisia were sniping at each other across their Saharan frontiers. And even the erstwhile partners in the United Arab Republic, Syria and Egypt, were engaged in a bitter ideological struggle. But diplomats who are trained to look behind and around are sometimes so artful at this that they fail to see what is right on before, clear and undenied. The Arabs never disguised the purpose of either of these summit conferences. They were designed for a single activity, to plan, to project, and to effect the final war of liberation, by which they mean the war which is to drive Israel into the sea. Why was there no war? The Arab inability to make good on the threats of January was a statement not of political maturity, of a new spiritual dimension to Arab politics, God willing. Rather, it was a tribute to their cold-eyed and calculating military realism. It was simply an inconvenient moment to launch an attack. 2 years before, General Nasser had promoted a civil war in the Yemen. He had been promoting revolutionary wars throughout the Middle East. And he had sent in his troops early on in the war as a military exercise. He would use this occasion in the Yemen, much as the fascists had used the civil war in Spain, to test out his armor for the real battle, the ultimate clash. But unfortunately, the Saudi Arabian government had rallied to the side of the Iman of Yemen, and the war had lingered on, and now one-third of his effectives were tied down in this rugged, high, and dry land. Syria was just recovering from one of her endemic military coups, and the throne of the Hashemite emperor of King Hussein in Jordan was, as usual, jittery and totty. This was no time to launch an attack, because General Nasser could not afford another Suez defeat. His political image, even in his own nation, has begun to tarnish. There was the 3-year debacle in the Yemen. There was the growing lack of foodstuff, of basic economic requirements within the Egyptian within Egypt herself. Egypt has had to purchase gold abroad. Egypt today must purchase 3/4 of its food requirements in foreign markets. Nasser has not been able to make good on his revolutionary promises to his own citizens to improve their standard of living. So Nasser could not afford another blunting of his stature. He had to bide his time. This time he must plan carefully. This time he must make sure. And so this Arab conference in January of 1964 and the follow-up conference in June and July of 1964 were designed to lay the groundwork, to establish strong and certain foundations from which the ultimate attack could be launched. And he made no bones about it. In the call to the conference, he said, maybe this month, maybe this year, it may be next, but the war will be. And though the Washington and London prefer to interpret the pronouncements and the agenda which came out of this conference as propaganda designed for internal Arab consumption, in point of fact, each of the items of this agenda has been put into operation and is now being effected. There has been created a joint Arab high command under Egyptian dominance. The Egyptian general Ali Ali Amr is the commander-in-chief of this Palestine Liberation Force. And the armies of Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt are being coordinated. Their officers have come together at a war college in Cairo and have struck final plans for battle. General Amr and his aides have investigated the entire length of the Israeli-Arab frontier and given out plans to strengthen these frontiers and for avenues of attack. Plans are underway to standardize equipment between these four nations. Russia, which continues to play the role of the provocateur in this area, has, as you know, shipped more than $1 billion worth of arms to Egypt in the last 4 years. 6 months ago, in order to speed up the standardization of the Arab army's equipment, she signed her first $250 million arms agreement with Syria. Little by little, the plans move ahead. Not only has there been launched an Arab high command under Egyptian control, designed to dominate, to plan, to coordinate, and to launch the final attack, the Arabs mean business. Some months ago, the United States government tried to bribe the two small nations, Lebanon and the Jordan, to withdraw from this compact. And our bribe was in terms of weapons. We would provide planes, and we would provide tanks, and we would provide artillery if they would reject the Russian arms via Syria and Egypt if they would reject the Egyptian dominance. The Arab response was clear and quick. Within a matter of weeks of this announcement in Washington, Egypt trumpeted that she had treated with the Lebanon, and the Lebanon was permitting the establishment on her soil of an Egyptian army base. The first time this military presence has been placed upon her territory. And King Jordan, who has for long been a puppet, a dependent of Washington, was forced to announce publicly what he had never announced before, that General Amr was indeed the commander-in-chief of the Liberation Force. He was forced to rescind the exile and the imprisonment of the Nasserite politicians in his own land who had been plotting against his life, lo, these many years. And he was forced even to revise the laws of succession to the throne so that a younger brother of his, King Hassan, Prince Hassan, who was very much pro-Egypt, is now next in succession. The Arabs mean business. And the Arabs have also brought into being a political entity, a paper state, in order to speed up and to make their business more effective. This state is called a Palestine government in exile. Its citizens are presumably the restless and impoverished ex-Palestine so-called refugees. The purpose of this government is to confuse world public opinion so that there can be an Egyptian puppet who will put out the claims of these refugees to repatriation, to land, to compensation, to disputed territory. But more than this, General Nasser appointed as president of this new paper state an old-time professional saboteur and manager of Palestine riots, a long-time admirer and friend of Adolf Hitler, Ahmed Zoukairi. Zoukairi has been empowered to organize again fedayeen raids, sabotage raids deep within Israel territory. And in the winter and spring of this year, for the first time in 9 years, these raids have in fact been carried out. The Palestine refugees are to be co-opted into these suicide missions. And though most of these missions have been aborted at the Israel frontiers, it is clear that these are to be provocative and damaging and the first stage of the Arab war. Not only is this new paper state, this puppet government, to play a role in military activity and a role in confusing world public opinion, the Arabs hope that it will play an ultimate and crucial role in the final attack. The Arabs expect to be able to say to the chancelleries of the world, yes, you have spoken to us often of the integrity of frontiers in the Middle East, but these men who are going in are not crossing frontiers. They are simply returning unto their own, going back to what is theirs. And they know that Israel must respond and must prevent such crossing. And they know that right behind this, the irregulars of this so-called Palestine government in exile, there is the Egyptian army with Soviet weapons, the Syrian army with Soviet weapons, and the Jordanian and the Lebanese armies with American weapons. The Arabs mean business. They mean to provoke, if they can, Israel to an attack. In June of 1964, the Arabs stated at their summit conference that if Israel went ahead and diverted the waters of the Jordan to its irrigation project, they would go ahead and dry up the headwaters of the Jordan and its tributaries so that there would be no water for Israel to draw from the Galilee down to the parched lands of the Negev. I think the issue here must be made clear. The Jordan is the key to the fertility of the lands east and to the west of it. These are parched lands, desiccated lands. They badly need irrigation. This has been seen for many years. In 1954, President Eisenhower, seeking to find some overall solution to the problems in the Near East to which all could agree, President Eisenhower sent Ambassador Johnston to this area. Ambassador Johnston arranged a water allocations treaty, which was initialed by all the hydraulic engineers and the agronomists of the affected nations. This treaty set up quotas, how much water each of the affected nations could draw from this large watershed. The Arab chiefs of state refused to sign this treaty. They will not sign any treaty which must be co-signed by Israel. This would admit that Israel is in fact in existence. But the United States chose to go ahead as if this treaty was in fact binding. And American engineers and American monies built in the Jordan a major irrigation work, the so-called East Gore Canal. And American engineers and American money is at the moment engaged in the Jordan in building another irrigation project, the West Gore Canal. Both of these projects are done within the terms of the Water Allocation Agreement of 1954. Seeing Jordan with American support going ahead with its projects, Israel naturally went ahead with its own. And the Jordan Valley water carrier is designed entirely within the terms of the treaty, initialed but never finally ratified, of 1958. For Israel knows that as she draws water and irrigates her land, as Jordan draws water and irrigates hers, as the standard of living of all these nations rises to its legitimate place, stability comes to the area. And with stability, there is a chance for peace. The projects which the Arabs announced at the summit conference have nothing to do with the beneficent flowering of the land. They are projects designed simply to dam up the water so that they will never reach Israel. In Syria and in the Lebanon, on the headwaters of the Hashbani and the Nawemi, the rivers are simply to be turned from east to west so that the waters will flow uselessly out into the salt of the Mediterranean Sea. These projects are already afoot. The oil-rich kingdom of Kuwait has given to the Jordan some $33 million to begin a big coffer dam at Mueba on the Yarmouk River, just 2 miles from the Israel frontier. A similar sum has been given by Kuwait to Syria and to the Lebanon to begin their coffer dams and their storage basins and their water diversion projects. Dredges and Caterpillar tractors and road widening equipment and men are even now in the field. Washington chose to see the statements of January and of June of 1964 as propaganda. They were meant as fact. And the fact has now been translated into reality. Let there be no mistake about it. The Arabs have never given up their announced, never denied purpose of destroying Israel, of erasing the people of Israel from the land, of driving them into the sea, of destroying all that we have built these past years in that part of the world. The Arab draws upon his own religious tradition to explain his revenge, for this is jihad, the ancient to the death vengeance of the Bedouin tribes. During the election campaign of 1965, when Nasser was re-elected unopposed to the presidency of the Egyptian nation, he spoke time and again to the cheering throngs in this vein: "We will not enter Palestine on a red carpet, but we will enter on a river of blood." Just a week ago, the dictator of Syria, Mr. Hafiz, told a group of visiting diplomats, "The war in Palestine is far nearer than you might think." And 2 weeks ago, there was convened in Cairo a strange meeting of Nasserite fellow travelers, a weird assortment of ex-Nazis and British anti-Semites and bought Western diplomats. And the high point of this conference was the appearance before it of our old friend Ahmed Sukeyri in full battle dress, guns slung across his shoulder. And he announced to thunderous applause, "I am ready for battle. We will march. We will march soon." The Arab intention is clear. And the Israeli response is equally clear. Israel, as any self-respecting nation, must defend its rights and the rights of its citizens, its right to survival. Israel has all along announced its willingness to sit down and seriously negotiate any outstanding dispute. Israel has all along announced its willingness to allow any water irrigation project to proceed within the terms of the 1954 agreement, provided that the project is designed for the well-being of the entire area. What Israel objects to is not the dams, but the damnable purpose to which the new projects have been launched. Israel must, as every nation must, look to its survival. How is its survival to be gained? In the first place, Israel must have a deterrent force. Israel must have an army which has sufficient firepower to counter the sophisticated weaponry now in the hands of the Egyptians and the Syrians and of their allies. Russia has poured $1 billion worth of the latest military equipment into Egyptian hands in 3 years. The Austrian and the German scientists now so busy in Egypt have built for Mr. Nasser an arsenal of rocketry and missile power. Rockets and missiles capable of hurling gas, and yes, even an atomic warhead, against the state of Israel. Israel has for a long been concerned with the state of her defense. She has a strong army. This has been proven again and again in 1948 and 1956. The people are prepared, if need be, to fight and to die. Today, war requires the weapons of war, and the weapons of war are increasingly complicated and intricate, and they must be bought from the great nations. That the imbalance of arms was a matter of concern was shown 4 years ago. President Kennedy allowed Israel to buy the Hawk ground-to-air missile in the United States. The first and only time that our government has allowed Israel to purchase arms directly in this nation. The American government over the past 2 or 3 years has allowed our allies to sell ex-NATO weapons to the to Israel. It's well to remember that the Israel-German arm purchase agreement, which exploded some weeks ago and then was put back together again, was negotiated not in Bonn, not in Jerusalem, but in Washington. The American government has, in other words, understood that the balance of arms in the Middle East is running against Israel. For our intelligence agents cannot but know that General Nasser has today more warplanes and more heavy tanks than the combined inventory of the Allied and the Axis armies during the African campaign in the Second World War. Israel needs arms. And the emphatic and troubled reaction of Israel to the German cancellation of the arms purchase agreement is a testimony to the urgency of Israel's needs. As you know, this little bit byplay of German realpolitik backfired on Bonn. Apparently, Bonn has now agreed, as part of the rearrangement which followed the Cairo-Bonn brouhaha of the last months, to complete the sale of tanks which was originally contemplated. But this is not enough. Just 2 weeks ago, the Soviet Union signed another arms purchase agreement with Egypt, in which they guaranteed to provide Egypt in the next 18 months with $250 million worth of new armament. Israel's little army will require continuing strengthening. And Israel has turned to the United States with the appeal that the United States directly undertake to sell the necessary weapons to her. And the United States has hesitated, dragged its feet, and has so far been unwilling to do so. Israel faces then a steadily deteriorating arms imbalance. The second greatest power in the world, the Soviet Union, is actively supporting Israel's two greatest enemies. The greatest power in the world is not yet actively supporting Israel. Israel must protect her defense, and she must protect her water. For in the Middle East, water is the stuff of life. If the land parches, if the harvest rot, the desert takes over the sown, and all that you have built and planned for and dreamed for is erased and canceled out. Many months ago, Premier Eshkol said it this way: the waters of the Jordan are as dear to us as the blood that courses in our veins. And to protect this water, we must take appropriate action. Now, the Arabs in their current program are gambling on American reaction. They are gambling that America will tell Israel, you may not take deterrent action, send in raids to bomb these dams or to do something of the sort. This is aggression. We cannot tolerate aggression. So far, let it be said, the American reaction has been entirely what the Arabs predicted. 3 months ago, when Ambassador Averill Harriman was uprooted from a Palm Springs vacation to rush off to the Near East after the bond thing blew up, he told the Israeli government in no uncertain terms that the American government would not tolerate aggressive action by Israel to break up these damnable water diversion projects, and that the American government insisted that before any action were undertaken, they must be consulted. They said the American government held that no action might legitimately be taken until it could be proven that the Arabs were diverting from the Jordan more waters than they had been allocated to them under the 1954 agreement. In brief, America was saying to Israel, let the waters of the Jordan fall. Prove to us that no more water is reaching your land. And then perhaps, after consultation and negotiation and meeting, then perhaps we'll allow you to take some action to defend your rights. Now, Israel perforce wonders at this holier-than-thou turning-the-other-cheek policy of our American government. It stands in such shattering contrast to our aggressiveness, our defense of our own rights in South Vietnam and elsewhere. Israel is in fact told to sit idly by and watch its own execution. And yes, there's a carrot at the end of the stick. The American government has told Israel, after all, we're building together a water desalination project. By the time 2 years from now, 3 years from now, the Arab dams are built, our desalination project ought to be in operation. You'll have a new source of water. Well, even if this desalination company is in being, why should Israel be deprived its legitimate rights in the Jordan Valley? And let it be remembered that there is no guarantee that the desalination project will be effective, that it can be constructed within this time, that in fact it will be constructed. Only now the first feasibility studies on this project are being run. And already it is clear that it will require not the $50 million originally contemplated, but $250 million to build it. Already it is clear that it will require not 3 years to complete, but a minimum of 6. And already it is clear that the water which it produces will cost Israel approximately 15 or 16 cents per cubic meter, which makes this water prohibitive for agricultural or for industrial use. Israel looks upon the American proposals very much as we look upon the proposals of some of those who argue against various methods of birth control, and who say to us that by the time the world is so full of people that no one can move about, we'll have perfected our interplanetary travel so that we can shoot off the extra population to the moon, to the sun, to the stars. Israel has tried to understand the nexus, the basis of American policy. And insofar as this policy is understandable, it seems to rest on an old proposition enunciated a decade ago by Secretary Dulles. And that proposition is, believe it or not, Mr. Nasser is a bulwark against communism, deterrent to communism in the Middle East. This seems to be a thread which runs constantly through our American approach to affairs in this part of the world. We look upon Nasser as one of the key figures in our Cold War battle. And Israel's aghast. It wonders how blind America can be. For Nasser, far from being a deterrent to communism, seems to be the man who is welcoming the Russians and the communist presence in the Middle East. Cairo is the port of entry for communist officers and communist observers throughout Africa, throughout the Middle East. In the last 5 years, the Arab states, especially Egypt, have taken the communist line at every international convention. The communists want us out of our giant air force base at Wheeler in Libya. And so it is the Egyptians who have begun to bring pressure against the Libyan monarchy to force us out. Russia would like to have British out of the oil protectorate of Aden. And so it is Nasser who has provided troops and men for guerrilla warfare to drive the British out. Russia is opposed to the United Nations settlement in the Congo. And so it is the Egyptians who have been the intermediaries, who have taken the Russian arms and shipped them to the Congo rebels and seen to it that they were delivered. And if you listen, as some do listen, to Radio Cairo, you will find that it is far more vitriolic and vehement about American warmongering and American colonialism and American cruelty and damnable activity than even Radio Moscow. Israel fails to understand how America at this moment in time can look upon Nasser as anything but an arch foe. Communism comes into an area when the area is in tumult and turmoil. And Nasser is the agent of tumult and turmoil throughout Africa, Central Africa, Northern Africa, throughout the Middle East, in fact, way into the far reaches of Asia. Nasser's saboteurs have been found in Iran, undermining a pro-Western government, in Turkey, undermining a pro-Western government, in Tunisia, undermining a pro-Western government, in Ethiopia, undermining a pro-Western government, in Pakistan, undermining a pro-Western government, indeed, wherever money and weapons can buy assassination. Why does Israel believe that the image of Nasser as a deterrent to communism still preoccupies American public State Department opinion? Because Israel knows that when Nasser was criticized by Washington for his actions in the Yemen and in Ethiopia and in the Sudan and in Libya and in the Congo, and when he in fact told the United States that if we didn't like the burning of our libraries and of our missions, we could go jump into the Mediterranean, and when the Senate of the United States in its wisdom assembled, expressing the outrage of the American people, voted almost unanimously to cancel any further aid agreement to Israel, to Egypt, the State Department interfered and forced a rescinding of this Senate resolution. And Israel knows that just 2 weeks ago, our Undersecretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, Mr. Phillips Talbot, was in Cairo. And the day after his departure, by obvious prearrangement, Cairo submitted to Washington a new request for $500 million worth of foodstuffs. And Israel is quite convinced that the State Department will see to it that it's granted. 4 months ago, the second in command of Egypt's Central Intelligence Agency fled to the west, to Iran. And when he was finally questioned by the Iranians and Western diplomats, he gave them proof that the Egyptians had been reshipping the wheat we have sent in to other nations for cash, and they'd use this cash to buy arms for the war in Yemen, for the ultimate war against Israel. And it has been patently clear to all of us that as we ship in hundreds of thousands of dollars a month worth of wheat and of other foodstuffs, Nasser is simply taking this item out of his domestic budget and transferring the freed coin to his military budget. In effect, our food aid, though it seems on the surface to be passive enough, increases Nasser's ability to wage war. And Israel wonders that we should, at this moment, after all of this past history, continue to support this megalomaniac. And yet we do. And by our actions and our statements to Israel as regards its possible deterrent attack against the dams being built, we have gone further. For we have thrown a shield of American protection over the Caterpillar tractors and the dredges and the working men who are building the cement piles which ultimately spell out Israel's destruction. And Israel wonders. Because Israel knows that over the past dozen or so years, America has generously supported her undertakings. And Israel is grateful for that generosity. And Israel knows that every American government since the Second World War has been sympathetic and friendly to her survival, because every American government has known that Israel is the only sturdy and dependable ally which we have in that part of the world. And Israel is grateful. And Israel cannot help but wonder that our policy is so hesitant, so unclear, so tortured, that we continue to send guns and tanks to countries pledged to the destruction of this democracy, that we continue to support the megalomaniac whose energy, whose ambition, whose appetite is the cause of so much of the unrest and the upheaval in our world. Will there be war in the Middle East? The Arabs are determined on it. On their schedule, they are determined on it. Israel alone cannot prevent war. Israel can defend her rights, but you cannot enforce peace. Russia is playing a devil's game in the Middle East. She is the provocateur, and she cannot be counted upon just to stabilize the area. And as so often in recent history, the fate of the Middle East rests upon the leadership of the Western world, upon our own nation, and ultimately upon our own president. Now, Mr. Johnson has a long and honorable history of concern with, of understanding of, Israel and her place in history. But unfortunately, Mr. Johnson also has a penchant for maneuvering, for dealing, for wheeling and dealing. And so much of the confusion of the past year has been created because American ambassadors have carried individual messages from our administration to this or that leader, proposing this or that proposal, and the leaders of these nations have read these proposals to suit their own convenience. What is required in the Middle East? Simply this: a clear reiteration of American policy. In 1954, America expressed its ultimate concern with the survival of Israel. Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy and Johnson, all three, have spoken of the need to guarantee the boundaries in the Middle East. Now we need to go a bit further. We need to express our understanding of Israel's legitimate right to take such action as she deems necessary to protect her survival. And if this means a bombing attack, Washington at least must know that Israel covets no territory, that all she would undertake is to destroy, to pull away the noose that's tightening around her neck. What needs to be stated now is simply this: that the United States will not tolerate any devious or direct action by the Arab world against Israel. That we will support Israel militarily and politically, and if need be, in a dire emergency. This being clear, victory is not worth the price to the Arab states. You cannot bribe a criminal not to commit his crime. Weapons, water projects, desalination projects, all manner of aid cannot buy peace in the Middle East. The only way to establish peace in this tortured place of the world is by a clear, no-nonsense, by a clear, definite commitment on the part of the Western nations, and especially in the part of our own nation, for the survival of Israel in its democratic freedom. Will this be? We can only pray that it will come to be. Washington, these past months, has maneuvered in all directions and often at cross purposes. Washington has, in effect, in these last months, moved to Israel's detriment. She has thrown a shield of protection around the water diversion projects of the Arabs. She has said to Israel, "Thou shalt not be an aggressor." But she has been unwilling to say to the provocateur, to those who are bound to destroy Israel, to those who have the knife at the jugular, "Thou mayest not go ahead, thou must desist." We have tried to buy off two of the small nations in the Middle East from their plans against Israel, Jordan and Lebanon. We have not been successful. We continue apparently to believe that Nasser can be controlled, can be domesticated, can be housebroken, if you will. And there is no reason to believe that this can in fact be. We have allowed our allies, to be sure, to sell some arms to Israel. We have continued to speak in most friendly terms to Israel, and we are essentially friends and allies. But we have not seen through the tangle of the political involvement. We have not cut through, or our State Department has not cut through, to the core of the matter, which is simply this: the Near East must be stabilized, and that stability will come only when the Arabs are convinced that they cannot achieve their end, that America will not tolerate it. Will there be peace in the Middle East? Let us pray that there will be so. Amen.